Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Michelle from San Diego.
I'm Michelle, and I'm an alcoholic. What a big crowd. And lots of friendly, familiar faces. I was born in 1950 in Connecticut, of French-Canadian descent. When I was 9, my dad got transferred to Indianapolis, Indiana. So I grew up there. I have 3 younger brothers and 3 younger sisters. A Catholic family, of course, Catholic schools. I believe my dad was a functioning alcoholic. It was a stressful household. We didn't know till we were older that we were kind of poor. We thought we were middle class. We had a nice house. We ate decent. We went to the Catholic school, and my mom shopped at the worst little craziest little stores you could ever think of. Both of my grandmothers sewed, and I made all my clothes. I made clothes for my little sisters. I made their communion dresses. I made their tennis dresses. My first drink was when I was a senior in high school. I was 17. I'd had like sips of beer that my dad had, but never really drank till I was 17. My girlfriend and I went to these dances for teenagers and little, kids clubs. And we snuck in our booze and put it in the toilets, behind the toilet lid. And the first time I got drunk, it was on gin and lemonade. And I don't know if anyone's been around and smelled Emerald perfume, but we were wearing Emerald perfume, and everything smelled like pine cones, and ugh, man, it was awful. And, of course, I had a ball, and I danced up a storm, and I fit in, and I was cool. And the next day I went to church and had the, oh, my God, the worst hangover. I never drank gin again, but it didn't stop me from drinking. Every Saturday we'd go to this little teenage nightclub, and we'd bring our booze in, and my goodness, by about, that was probably September or October, maybe by February or something, I was so smashed and so bombed that I broke the bottle all over the bathroom floor. And the girls called the security guards, and then they got me, and then they called my parents, and my parents had to come and get me, and I got grounded for a couple weeks. And I didn't drink for a while. I didn't drink for a while, but I got kind of chubby because I'd been date raped a little while, a few months before that. And I got depressed, and I gained weight, so my mom took me to the diet doctor, and I took prescription diet pills. And I got myself a little boyfriend. I wasn't drinking, but I was doing the little diet pills. And when, let's see, about maybe April or so of my senior year, when I was still 17, I got pregnant by my little 16-year-old boyfriend. And being the oldest of the 7 kids, my youngest sister was about 4 at the time. And I told you I sewed. I wanted to be some kind of designer. My mom's parents lived in Fort Lauderdale. And I was to go to a year school there, a little woman's little college, and make patterns and make dresses and, you know, get into the fashion industry. Well, I got pregnant instead, and that took care of that. But, of course, being Catholic and being in the Midwest and being 1968, you kept those kind of things a secret because it would ruin my reputation and it would affect my younger brothers and sisters. It would ruin their reputations. So we devised this plan to send me to Florida anyway and pretend I was going to school. So I pretended I was going to school for about 3 months or however long until I could get to the home, Catholic home for unwed mothers in Indianapolis. So I snuck in under the cover of darkness and went to this home for unwed mothers, and no one knew I was there. Like, my friends didn't know I was there. My brothers and sisters didn't know I was there. I still pretended I was in Florida going to the school. The father, I mean, geez, he was like a junior in high school or a senior in high school by now. You know, the poor kid. I'm losing my train of thought. Okay, so I have the baby. I give it up for adoption. And then I go back to Florida, and I actually go to school for a few months. And then the school closed. And, oh, I know what I was thinking. I lost all my friends because I couldn't keep in touch with anyone because I'm not real good at lying, and I couldn't make up a story to tell them. And so my parents kind of pushed me away from, like, my good girlfriends and stuff because they didn't want to get this information out of me. So I go back to Indianapolis, and I get a little job in a department store, and I get this new boyfriend, the one that date raped me years before, after he got home from Vietnam. And we used to go to nightclubs all the time, and I used his sister's ID. I was underage, and we'd drink, and I'd get drunk, and we'd party, and we'd dance. And I was on the diet pills again, still, after the baby. And I remember one time we went out on a Sunday afternoon with some friends, and we went horseback riding, and I'm like the totaliest unathletic person you ever want to meet. I mean, I can't even imagine myself on a horse. I mean, it's amazing. And then we went to a bar to have a drink, and they had beer, and I had a mixed drink. And it was, everything I did was wrong. Like, I rode the horse wrong. I had the wrong drink. I mean, everybody's having beer. What's wrong with you? You're having this. And I went home, and I kept thinking, I want to forget. So I had some headache pills. I don't even know what they were. And I had my birth control pills, and I had my little diet pills. And I just took a whole bunch of pills, thinking I want to forget. And my mom, and I didn't tell my mom and dad. And I remember my dad walking me around the block, because I must have been really fucked up. I mean, I didn't tell him what I had done, of course, because they would have put me in the hospital. And I think a girlfriend told him a couple days later. And I came out of it okay, but I was really sick for about 3 days. I mean, I crashed. I was just really out of it. So then I kind of decided that I was going to become a hippie because the straight world was no good. My parents, this boyfriend. So I was this little girl who worked in a department store during the day. They had just invented pantyhose, birth control, pantsuits. I mean, that's how long ago it was. And then at night, I would take my bra off and pretend to be a hippie and go to this hippie nightclub where they had hard rock and roll and drugs and pot and stuff. And I kind of, I guess I always led this kind of double life. And also, I'm very codependent. I wanted to fit in. And at that time, I have to tell you, I didn't do a lot of drinking because it wasn't cool. But I did other stuff. I ended up getting fired from, my mom and dad told me I could either stop seeing this guy or move out. And I said, well, I'm going to move out. And then he stopped seeing me because he had three other girlfriends anyways. And then this girlfriend and I, she said she found these credit cards, but I think she stole them. And she would come into the department store where I worked, and I would sell her stuff but not check on the call and see if we would get approval. And I got busted for that and taken to jail, and I wouldn't tell anybody. My dad had me seeing a shrink at the time, and I wouldn't tell anybody. Oh, no. I didn't trust adults. I didn't trust grown-ups. I had isolated myself. I had no mentors or, you know, we were, our little family of seven kids and the king and the queen. Well, she wasn't even quite a queen. She was a worker bee. We were it, you know. We kids didn't have anybody else to go to bounce stuff off or get advice from. So anyways, I ended up going to jail for a night, and this girl and I ended up just paying restitution. The couple was very nice, and we didn't have to, the charges were dropped, but we paid them back. And I was so naive at the time. I was so stupid, I wasn't thinking I was hurting anyone. They were strangers. It was a credit card. I didn't know them from Adam. I was getting something free. But not till I got older did I realize, you know, I'm jeopardizing their family, their credit, they're worried, they're freaking out. None of that stuff ran through my mind. So not too long after that, I wasn't doing much of anything. Didn't have the boyfriend. Didn't have too many friends. Didn't have a job. And the girl that we did this credit card scheme with, she was going to drive a car to California. You know, the driveway cars, and they pay you to deliver it. We had a girlfriend out here who was living with some friends in Mission Beach. And so on a Thursday, I told my parents I was moving to California. And on Tuesday, I left. And I had $35, a bathing suit, three T-shirts, and three pairs of jeans. And 11 of us were living in this little house in Mission Beach. And we had a lot of fun. And we did. We drank and we did other stuff and got little waitress jobs. And if any of you are familiar with Pacific Beach, Mission Beach, I got a job at the Denny's. And I got fired because I'm obsessive compulsive in so many things because I put too much whipped cream on the hot fudge sundaes. They fired me. With no warning. God, where does my story go from there? And I have this friend who was older than me. She was divorced. She had been married to a Charger football player. She had two kids, two little rugrats, little beach kids, little surfers and skateboarders. And she was a free woman now. And I was a good partner for her because she was a stone fox of the beach. And I was not quite as attractive as her, and she got all the attention. And she had to teach me to drink again because I hadn't drunk for a couple years. And so we'd go to the restaurants and bars at Mission Beach, and we'd order me pitchers of grasshoppers so I could get used to drinking again. And then I graduated to wine, and we'd go to happy hours, and I'd get drunk. I was still a waitress, and I think we got off about 9, and we'd hit the little bars around our area. And we used to do psychedelics. And one day, and we had this pact kind of that we would stick with each other when we did the psychedelics. And we were at a restaurant bar in Mission Beach, and it was during the day, and we were doing our psychedelics. And we were having drinks in the bar, and she was talking to another, this guy, this old friend of hers, and they were talking and carrying on, and I mean, just having a conversation. And I am so inept at meeting people and talking to people, and I just felt so less than and so out of it and just worthless and all that stuff. So I went home. And I took some more pills again, some pills that a friend had for some kind of sleeping pills. And boy, I didn't call. I didn't ask anybody for help. The beach is a little community where, I mean, you just trot two doors down and there's another friend's house. But no, I didn't do that. And this time I was really thinking I wanted to commit suicide because I just was less than and useless and worthless and not good enough and all that kind of stuff. And, boy, I crawled around on my hands and knees for about 3 days after that one. Of course, I didn't ask for help. I probably came pretty close to dying. I probably did. So I stopped doing psychedelics for a while and just picked up on the drinking. Then, let's see, I went to nursing school. When I was pregnant, there was a lady named Mrs. Murphy, a nurse. And I always remembered her. And I always thought I might want to be a nurse. And one of my girlfriends who I worked with was a nurse. And she and her husband were really good friends to me. And they kind of helped me walk through what to do. I was 20. How old was I? 24, I think. And I hadn't been to college or anything. And school was very frightening to me. And it was a one-year course. And so I had this little studio at the beach, and it was $100 a month, utilities included. And I saved $1,000, and I got a $1,000 grant and a $1,000 loan, and I went to nursing school. And I didn't have to work for 6 months. I lived on $5,000 that year or something. It was amazing. So I went to nursing school, and that was a pretty calm year because I was studying, and there were the times when I'd call in sick, and I'd be drinking with my friends and stuff. Then when I got out of nursing school, I was waiting to take my test, and I got a little chunky again, so I went to the diet doctor again, another time here in California, and got some prescription diet pills, and I was still waitressing, and every night after I got off work, I went home, took a shower, changed clothes, and just trotted my little self all around Mission Beach, all by my little self, and just was a holy terror. I mean, because I could drink more with what I was doing. I mean, I could drink a lot. And I just hit all the little bars. And I wanted a man so bad. I wanted to be in a relationship so bad. And I wanted to be in love so bad. And I went about it all ass backwards. I mean, I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I was like a steamroller. I mean, holy moly. Oh, God. Awful, awful, awful. So not even assertive, aggressive and frightening. And it's a wonder I didn't get killed, my throat slit or something. Because, boy, I mean, oh, the choices I made were pretty bad. And I couldn't understand how come nobody loved me. You know? I mean, hi, you want to come home with me? Let's fall in love. Let's get married. Let's have kids. It's like, you could be the Boston Strangler for all I know, you know? So that was a bottom. So there I had the one suicide attempt, another suicide attempt, and this turned into a big bottom because I was a mess, a mess, a mess, a mess. And every couple years or so, I'd go home to Indianapolis, and I had this buddy, Ron, who I used to be obsessed with his running partner from the nightclub we used to go to, and he just crashed at my house when he needed a place to stay. And Ron scared the shit out of me because he was a drug dealer, and I didn't like him. But I liked this goofy friend who paid me no attention really whatsoever. And but Ron and I kind of over the years, I saw that he was nice. He treated me nice. Like I went home one time and this other boyfriend, he was crashed the whole time. He could give a shit if I was home. And Ron took me and he bought me an ice cream cone. And that was like one of the nicest things people had ever done for me. You know, I mean, in the middle of the day. I mean, he felt sorry for me because this jerk was asleep when I was coming over. And so Ron and I would kind of keep in touch. And I went home the Christmas after I got out of nursing school and was doing all the diet pills and looking really good, but was a mess of mess from picking up all kind of crazy guys and gotten mess after mess. And just had to kind of chill for a while. So I went home, and Ron and I, we were like little magnets or something. I went this way, and he went that way. And we both kind of looked at each other and said, oh, you're the one for me. We both wanted a relationship. We both wanted a relationship. And one of the reasons I fell in love with him was because he had this little Volkswagen that didn't have any heat. And the floorboards were all rotted, and there was like ice on the in the car, and you had to scrape the inside of the windshield with because it was icy. And he was so nice. He said, "Here's a blanket to keep you warm." I mean, geez, what more could a girl ask for? And plus, he had alcohol and pot and drugs too. So we just kind of fell head over heels in love. And I came back here, got all my stuff together in about 2 weeks, and moved back to Indianapolis. And I kept saying, "Are you going to marry me? Are we going to get married?" I was still pushy. Are you going to marry me? Are you going to marry me? And he said, "If we're going to get married, I'm going to ask you." So I came in about 8 o'clock in the morning, and we split a Valium, and we were the first people, the only people in the bar, having Bloody Marys at 8 in the morning, and he asked me to marry him. And I, oh, yes. And it was a cold-ass winter that year. It was 28 below zero. Not the wind chill factor, 28 below zero. And, like, there were ice on the roads in the little streets. You just, the ice froze, but you had the tire tracks, and you had to make sure you stayed in that, you know, to get around. So my mom wanted me to get married, but they wouldn't let me get married in the Catholic Church because I wasn't Catholic anymore, and I wouldn't promise to go to church. And his mother wanted us to have a wedding, and shit, nobody had any money. They didn't have money. I didn't have money. We didn't have anything. So we did the next best thing. We eloped for $15, 28 below zero. And we got some George Dickel for a wedding present.
Oh, yeah.
And we weren't cold. We got that nice whiskey, and we weren't cold. And they said, "What the hell has she done now?" And 33 years later, we're still married. So we partied. We partied in Indianapolis, and I got a nursing job in hospitals, and he had a job. And I partied. I'm very codependent. I didn't like pot, but I smoked it anyway because it was cool. And we did our fair share of drinking, and we drank a lot of Wild Irish Rose. And you could smell it, like, to the back row because it was so potent and pungent. And I worked, and I had a few times when I called in hungover. And I always wanted to come back to California. I'd say, "I miss my beach. I miss my beach." We saved our money, and we came out here. And we got a little place in Mission Beach, and we drank a lot. We drank a lot of beer. We drank a lot of Crown Royal. One of our friends, when he couldn't get Quaaludes anymore, he said, "I discovered this wonderful thing, Crown Royal. It's just as good as Quaaludes." And or the next best thing. So we got into Crown Royal, and Crown Royal and beer and pot. And we get these little half pints, and I would pace myself. We would split the half pint. I would have two beers. I would have some pot, and I would go to bed at 7 o'clock so I could get up and go to my nursing job the next day. And that went on for a long time, night after night after night. And if I went to bed at 7 o'clock, I really didn't have too much of a hangover because I really controlled it. But if I was off the next day, the sky was the limit. And I had 100 Crown Royal bags at one point. And I was going to make a quilt, but it it seemed like too much work. So anyways, we went on like that for a while. And then all of a sudden, that stuff that allows you to drink more came into our lives. And it wasn't pills this time. We snorted it. And boy, oh boy, oh boy. Boy. I mean, I turned into a mess after about a couple years. Still drinking the Crown Royal, still beer, and doing that go fast stuff. And at my hospital, there was an alcohol and drug treatment center. And I used to float all around, and I got my neighbor, I worked the day shift, and I got my little LVN neighbor a job there, and she worked she lived downstairs from us. She worked the PM shift, and we used to wait for her to come home so we could party and do Go Fast, and we just sat around our table and we talked for, till sunrise, and God knows what we said. We solved all the world's problems, I guess, and we would say, what is wrong with those people in that drug rehab? All they do is sit around and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. They're weird. We should have been there. I should have been there. I belonged there. And anyways, I ended up hitting my bottom. My bottom lasted about a year. And I was in that whole time in that place where I didn't know how to stop. But it didn't work. And I kept trying it anyway. And every once in a while I'd get high and I'd, get drunk, and most of the time I cried, and it was just awful. I was paranoid. I was picking at my skin. Ron and I were fighting like crazy. We'd lost all our friends over stupid stuff and over that Go Fast stuff. And then I started doing just what Randy was talking about. I kind of got off the Go Fast, and I just was changing crazy drinks for me. I wasn't drinking the Crown Royal anymore. I was drinking vodka with fresh squeezed orange juice, trying to find something that worked, but nothing worked. Nothing worked. And we ended up seeing a therapist who was sober, and that was around Christmas time of 88. And she would always say, we're not going to know what's going on with you until you take away the drugs and the alcohol. And she'd always say, are you ready to go to treatment now? And I'd say, no. And I'd cry. And she'd say, well, what did you do all weekend? And I'd say, I got drunk and I cried. April. By April, I had decided I was ready to go into treatment. I went to see her on a Monday, and I came home and I told Ron, I'm going into rehab on Wednesday. Holy shit. He's like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? And I did. I stuck to my guns. I was finally ready. I just couldn't do it anymore. It didn't work anymore. So in that respect, God gave me a very gentle bottom. So I went into treatment, and they discovered that I suffer from depression. I've been on antidepressants for 20 years. It works for me. I need it. When I first got sober, I had a really hard time. I don't know if it was all my issues coming up. I don't know if it was hormonal. But I cried and cried and cried, and I just hung on. There were times when I just hung on with everything I had, and please, God, just help me, because I was in such pain and such despair. Those first few years weren't fun for me, but for some reason, I didn't drink. God helped me. The program helped me. You guys helped me. I just kept with it. I just kept putting one foot in front of the other. And at first I was very resentful that I couldn't drink anymore, because everybody I knew drank and partied. And it was like, holy shit, what do you do now, everything, I was starting everything from scratch, starting brand new, and had to learn how to do everything. I still don't socialize well. It's amazing. I'm up here in front of all you guys. I know my neck's just beet red. For me, the miracle happened. The miracle to me was when I was happy to be sober. And the obsession was pretty much removed from me early on. And for any of you who are new, there's new people here, I swear to you on my life, the obsession will be removed. It might be a little longer for some people, but it'll happen. You stick it out, the obsession will be removed. I went to therapy for about 5 or 6 more years. I did my aftercare. I've kept going to meetings. I've had about 6 sponsors, I think. And I always opt for the easier, gentler, softer way. It's like the buddy system to me. I need comfort. I need guidance, but comfort. I'm not the don't beat me up. That's not going to work. And so sponsors have been a wonderful thing. When I really, really knew there was a God, I mean, I've always known there was a God, but God is in us. God is in nature. I was looking out my kitchen window when I was about 2 years sober, and there was this little bitty little thing. And I thought it was a bee, and it was a hummingbird, and it was teeny. And I said, there is a God. You know, God's been very good to me. Ron followed into treatment maybe 9 months after me. We've been together all this time. He works his program. I work my program. I've worked on a lot of issues. Early on in sobriety, when I'd go to battery chargers, I would, like, feel sicker than everybody, like not as good as it, I was, worse than everybody, even in sobriety. And there was a wonderful woman who once said, you know, I don't think it's some people are sicker. I think some people are more wounded. And I really liked that. That was kind of, took some pressure off of me because I was wounded from all my experiences. I wouldn't trade my sobriety for anything. And the only reason I have my sobriety is because I have a program, because I have a higher power. I couldn't do it by myself. There's no way I could do it by myself. I've worked the steps. I got the sponsor. I pray. I pray in the shower in the morning. I get down on my knees at night. I've been praying all day. So that I say the right stuff, that I say something that makes sense to somebody and can carry some kind of message. Larry had to, like, break my arm to get me up here. I said, I can't do that. I have to work. He said, well, what time do you get off work? I said, 3:30. He says, what's that got to do with anything? So here I am. My program does mean a lot to me. My sobriety means a lot to me. We're miracles. We're all miracles. We're all blessed. I feel so blessed. I feel so lucky. My life is so good. I keep it simple. I don't deal with stress very well, so I don't try to, like, make a lot of stress. I don't, like, try to make a lot of problems and drama and chaos like I did before. I know anonymity is important, but in my profession, I've encountered people recently. One has a tracheostomy, and she can't talk, so she writes everything down, and she can't eat, so she has a tube in her stomach, and she keeps falling, and she keeps ending up in like rehab little home. And I said, what did you do? Did you have vodka again? She pours it in her tube. She said, no, wine. I said, oh, my God. She broke her arm. She broke her leg. Another one recently, who supposedly was sober for a year or two, had a relapse and fell on her face at 7-Eleven and broke her nose and broke her jaw, and her teeth are wired, and she can't eat anything, but she doesn't have a problem. So, you know, I'm grateful. I'm grateful, and I'm blessed, and I'm lucky, and we're all lucky. And this miracle isn't to be taken for granted. And, you know, I've been sober a long time. I'll be 21 next month. But I have to be ever vigilant. Because, man, it can just, you know, creep up on you. There's still the times when I go, I'd like to have a drink. And then I go, where the heck did that come from? And I remember one night having a dream where I had it was a margarita, and it had the little ice cubes and the salt. And I took one sip. I thought, oh, should I do this or not? I took one sip, and then I go, ah, shit, I've already done it. Might as well finish it now. And those dreams feel so real, and I wake up and I'm so grateful that they're not real. But that time I woke up with the hiccups. So I still have my using dreams, and I still have my drinking dreams, and thank God they're only dreams. And you know what? For any of you who are frightened by that, please don't be, because it's just our subconscious letting stuff out. It doesn't mean we're bad. It doesn't mean we're wrong. It's normal. It's normal for us to do that. It's what we do while we're awake that really counts. So don't feel guilty. Don't feel guilty. You know, get a sponsor. Go to meetings. This can be done. This can be done. I was lucky I didn't relapse, but like I told you, my bottom dragged on for about a year. And once I had made that decision, I pretty much stuck with it. Because it didn't work anyway. So why, you know, it didn't work. I couldn't get high. I couldn't forget. I couldn't anything. And I know it's getting time to close. I'm grateful. If this is as good as it gets pretty good. I still am not a ball of fire. I'm really not. I've got the time changes. He asks me to do this when the time changes, so I got to get up at 5 tomorrow and go to work at 6 and take care of all these crazy people with their tubes and their jaws and following me around asking for their pain medicine, but saying, I'm not addicted, but 5 more minutes, I can't wait 5 more minutes. So that makes me grateful. It makes me grateful. Ron and I have a great life. My two of my sisters are coming this week from the Midwest to see us, and I'm so excited. And I think there's some alcoholics in my family. They're functioning alcoholics. My brothers, my sisters, my one sister, she won't drink. We'll go out and have a margarita, and she'll drink half of it and leave it there. And it's like, what's wrong with you, Meme? Why are you, Meme? You know, don't you want to finish your drink? God, I don't know what else to say. There's hope. There's hope. And I don't hope I didn't dwell too much on my story before. But I found my boy. I found my boy who I gave up. And I told you I was French-Canadian descent. I named him Etienne. And that is the French name for Stephen. And I remember when I was in therapy, I would go in crying, and my therapist, I said, I'm grieving for my son. And she goes, well, you can look for him. And it never dawned on me because I signed papers that said I will never try to find him or anything. And they have the computer where if you both are in it and it matches up and you both want to find each other, then the records are open to you. And I found him, and I fell madly in love with him until he went through his manic depressive bipolar stage at my house, and was seeing the CIA in the bushes, and wouldn't take medicine and wouldn't see a doctor, and I kicked him out and said, I just can't do this anymore. And maybe 8 years later or something, I said, life's too short, and I took him back into my life. And he's stable. He's taking his medicine. He has a good life. He lives in Colorado. He was adopted by an ex-nun and a professor, and he grew up in Rhode Island. And they wanted children very badly and obviously couldn't have children. They gave him a very good life. And as happens quite frequently, she got pregnant right after they adopted him. So he has a brother, and we call him your son and mine. And life is good, and sobriety is good, and I've lost my mom when I was sober. I lost my dad when I was drinking. It was better losing my mom when I was sober than when I lost my dad. You know, there's death, there's taxes, there's illness, there's sickness, there's jobs, there's, you know, but everybody has to go through that shit, not just us. And the program teaches you how to do it on the natch, which I never knew how to do before. I didn't know how to do anything on the natch. And thanks.